never to tolerate that kind of relentless targeting again, and weaker because I still did not fully understand the true toll the abuse had taken. It would be many years before I really came to understand what a problem the protective veneer I was creating could be. In eighth grade, just to show how insanely fickle middle schoolers can be, I was voted most popular girl. There was no pleasure in that for me, only a tentative sense of security. It meant nothing more to me than insurance against another round of targeting. Perhaps now I had some power. I resolved that I would do whatever it took not to go through that misery again. I also vowed to protect my friends from bullies whenever possible. A short time later, Kelly told me the class ringleader had begun to torment her again. The group was starting to turn. Kelly had already had her turn of torture as their target. "Not again," Kelly told the ringleader. "She's already been through it," I said to the mean girl. "Stop." Amazingly, she stopped. To this day, I can handle people who are dumb, lazy, or generally annoying. The one thing I cannot and will not tolerate is a bully. Still, I was never able to reclaim my innocence about humanity. The most enduring legacy of being bullied was that I understand on a cellular level that other people being cruel to you is part of life, but that this too shall pass. And that every time you drag yourself to school or your job, even when you don't want to go, you make yourself a little more resilient. It's like working out. Every time you do it, your muscles break down. The tiny fibers tear a bit. Then they grow back, stronger and more defined. And the next time it happens, you can take more weight. That doesn't mean bullying is a good thing. It can create very deep wounds. But enduring it does develop some life skills, as long as you can get past the scar tissue. And until about 2 decades later, I thought I had. That summer, after middle school, Mom took me to get my teeth fixed. I took up running and lost 15 pounds and entered high school looking like a new person. I wondered if this was the beginning of my Farrah Fawcett moment. Looking somewhat prettier and having been through the grind once already, I felt my own power much more in high school. I was done being an outcast, and I refused to put up with any bullshit. I became head cheerleader and president of our high school sorority. One day in the locker room, an older girl growled at me and then called me a bitch twice. "If you call me that one more time," I said, "you're gonna regret it." She said it again. I let her have it. We ended up rolling on the ground in our cheerleading uniforms, pulling at each other's hair. This sounds far sexier than it actually was. The gym teacher had to pull us apart. I'm no advocate of violence, but I do believe in self-defense. And the growler? She never bothered me again. Chapter 3. Silent Night, Holy Night. At the start, high school was a breeze. I was happy and popular, getting mostly A's while also finding time to work, first as a babysitter, then as a sales clerk. My planned pursuits, according to my yearbook, were college, government, and wealth. For the record, I have no recollection of wanting to be in government. By my sophomore year, I was 15 years old and the last child living at home. My parents and I love one another and still had dinner together almost every night. But I tested the limits like all kids do, including shoplifting once. One Halloween, Kelly's mother denied us some costume jewelry we wanted from Kmart. So we stole it. Later, we put the jewelry on, at Kelly's house, right in front of her mother. "Where did you get those star earrings and plastic necklaces?" Kelly's mom asked us. "Megan's mother gave them to us," Kelly said. Mrs. McGinnis knew better. Megan's mother had 2 pairs of enormous plastic star earrings and necklaces. "Yes," we lied. "I'm calling Mrs. Kelly," she said, "and you 2 girls better go down in the basement and pray to God that she tells me she had 2 pairs of that hideous jewelry and gave it to you in between the time you asked me to buy it for you and right now." So we did. We went down in the basement and prayed that my mother would lie. "Yeah, right. I just got off the phone with her," Kelly's mom said. "What'd she say?" I asked, as if I didn't know. "She said your father will be over to take you both back to Kmart as soon as he finishes his meatloaf." We had to return the items and apologize to the store manager. He was gracious, but told us we could have been arrested, that he'd seen it many times. I never stole another thing. Another time, Kelly and I threw a boozy party when my parents were out of town. Stupidly, we took pictures and neglected to hide them, landing us in huge trouble. My sister was the first to talk to my mom after she saw the photos on the kitchen counter. "Well?" I asked Suzanne. She said, "You have no life left." Yet another time, Kelly and I told our parents we were going to the Saratoga racetrack, but actually went to see some boys on Long Island. "How was the track today?" Mom asked. "It was great," I responded. "We won big." "The track's closed on Tuesdays," she said. "Busted." Suffice it to say, Kelly and I were not exactly criminal masterminds. But thankfully, our rebellious streak was a minor thing. While Kelly was a devilish influence on me, all my memories with her are good ones. We were more like sisters than friends. She spent so much time at my house, my mother used to call us the boarders, and we had a lot of fun. It was in no small part because of her friendship that school and life were both going smoothly for me. But that's often how these things are, right before everything changes. 10 days before Christmas, 1985, my family was beginning to gather together for the holiday, with Suzanne home from college. Pete was attending college nearby and was frequently underfoot, though on this particular day, he had opted to watch a football game with his friends rather than at home. I wanted to get the same class ring Kelly was ordering. Dad said it was too expensive. I kept complaining, and he kept saying we couldn't afford it. I wouldn't let it go. He'd had it. He turned and walked out of the kitchen. That was the last exchange I would ever have with my father. I watched him walk toward the living room, and then I stormed up to my bedroom without saying goodnight or even acknowledging him. I turned out the light and went to sleep angry. The last image I have of my father alive is of him alone on the couch, staring at the Christmas tree. That sight would haunt me for the rest of my life. The picture of a good man, exasperated and alone. Just before midnight, Suzanne ran into my bedroom. "Wake up," she shouted. "Daddy had a heart attack." I ran downstairs just as the paramedics arrived. They began performing CPR on Dad. Red lights were flashing in our living room. Mom, Suzanne, and I struggled to push our large German Shepherd, who was trying to be by my father, into the basement to keep her from getting in the way. The EMTs hastily loaded my father onto a stretcher and then into the ambulance. One of them was a friend of my brother's. I remember his face vividly. It was grave, and he had tears in his eyes. The ambulance raced to the hospital. Mom, Suzanne, and I followed behind, driven by our neighbors, who had heard the commotion and come over. When we arrived, we were told to wait in a private room. It seemed like we were there for many hours, but it was probably less than one. At last, the doctor came in and looked at us, shaking his head. "There was nothing we could do," he said. I remember standing in the corner of the room and feeling my knees bend. A small green metal trash can sat beneath me, and I felt it hit the back of my legs as they buckled. They invited us to see him, to take a look at my dad, who had been alive 2 hours earlier and looking at the Christmas tree, to say goodbye to my dad, with whom I had argued over a class ring and who I had disappointed with my selfishness. He was lying on a hospital bed with a cut on his upper nose where his glasses hit him when he went down. He looked peaceful, and it was clear he was gone. One by one, we held his hands. It was too much to bear. We were all in shock. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, as we were leaving the hospital, I stood next to my mother in the parking lot under a pitch-black sky. "Will you ever be happy again?" I asked. "Of course I will, honey. And you will be, too." Mom couldn't afford to take time off from her job. Just a few months before my dad died, he had canceled an extra life insurance policy, thinking that he was 45 and healthy, and we needed to save money. When she got home from work at the hospital, she would sit in the garage and sob, alone, before she came inside. She tried to put on a brave face for me, but I knew. Money was certainly a stressor. My dad had bought a new car a couple of weeks before he died. The car company gave my mom a terrible time about the payments, even though they knew the situation in full. She just wanted to give the car back, It was 2 weeks old. It hadn't seen a lot of wear and tear. And yet they wouldn't take it, and were threatening to sue her. It was more than she could handle at that moment. Our family lawyer, Peter Walsh, had been one of my father's closest friends. A well-respected attorney in Albany, he shared my dad's passion for religion, philosophy, and music. He told my mother not to worry. "I'm going to handle this, Linda," he said. And he did. He sent the car company a one-line letter. "Go fucketh thyselves." As someone who later became a lawyer and a communicator for a living, I think about that letter often. Sometimes less is more when it comes to showing someone what a moron they are. The company took back the car. But money was such a small piece of what my mother had to deal with in her grief. A person can encounter such inadvertent cruelty after losing a spouse. Most of my parents' friends were married. Once she lost her other half, so many people seemed to write her off. It was as if she had ceased to exist outside of her marriage to my dad. This was driven home when some friends of the family were in town right after the funeral. The husband and his wife took my mom to the store, trying to get her mind off of things. They meant well. When she came home, it was clear she was upset. Later, she told me how affectionate the man had been with his wife. He held her hand, he helped her in and out of the car, he kissed her. My mom saw it all and felt so alone. He didn't do it on purpose, but sometimes people don't recognize life's little cruelties. The number one thing I remember from that time was overwhelming sadness, which we each dealt with in our own way. My mom was strong but in deep mourning for a very long time. For the next year, she went to church almost every day. I preferred biking to my father's grave to sit there and be with him. His tombstone has a fishing pole on it. Dad loved to fish. Every time I'd see an impossibly long book or hear a word I didn't know, I'd think of him. I still do. One of the only releases we had was TV. Mom loved the Golden Girls and the Jeffersons. It's actually one of the reasons I love TV as much as I do today. During that awful time, it was an escape for both of us, something we could do together on the weekends. Mom would say, "Let's have a TV marathon," and we'd light a fire in the fireplace. Kelly would come over. We'd all get under blankets, order dinner in, and watch a marathon of Little House on the Prairie. And for a while, we would forget how sad we were. My other strategy for coping was to throw myself into school life. I had been voted homecoming princess and started dating a popular boy in the junior class. Socially, I felt accepted. Kelly and my other friends were there to cheer me up and to make me feel cared for during that awful time. We asked God for signs a lot in those days, signs that my dad was still around. Every time we asked, we received. Not long after he died, Mom had a bad asthma attack and wound up in the hospital. She was upset and overwhelmed and asked for a sign. Sure enough, later that day, she was looking for something in her purse while still in her hospital bed, and out popped a small card my father had sent her with some roses years earlier. I realize this kind of thing can be explained in any number of ways, but my own belief is, who are we as mere mortals to say there is no power beyond? To presume all of this energy, this beautiful, strong, complex energy, just dies when our hearts stop beating. I believe my father's spirit lives on, and I believe somehow he got that card to my mother that day. Whether it was through sitting at his grave, or in church, or in front of the TV, we had to endure. It was like giving blood at the doctor's office. Sometimes you have no choice. The needle is going to pierce your vein. Your blood's going to pump out. It is going to hurt. So too it is with grief. There will be a bloodletting, whether you want it or not. You grit your teeth and bear it until the acute tenderness has passed, and then one day you realize it has. It took years to feel anything but deep regret about the terms my father and I were on that last night. I wished I'd made up with him before I went to bed, or that I'd been less shallow. Me being bratty and him being fed up, that had never been what our relationship was about. I hated that it ended on that note, rather than after any of the days we had spent talking about books or playing music and dancing. It's taken years to get to a place where I can believe that my father has forgiven me for my pettiness and vanity in those hours before he died. I try not to let that memory make me paranoid about my relationships with others. At first, when I would fight with my husband, Doug, I would wonder if we should try to make up before bed. Because what if? When they say you should never go to bed angry, I know why firsthand. But the truth is that even after my dad's death, I found this adage unrealistic. Sometimes you're angry. Sometimes you're tired. Sometimes you can't resolve things before you close your eyes. If I ever fall asleep mad at Doug, and then die before we make up, I just have to trust that he knows I love him. As for my kids, I've never gone to bed angry with them. In fact, I've never really been angry with them. Of course, they're not yet teenagers who want meaningless and expensive class jewelry. Still, like my mom, I believe strongly in conflict resolution, and never more than a day will pass before Doug and I work out our differences. For a very long time, I was consumed by thoughts of our loss. "Mom," I said one night, "I keep dreaming about Dad. Then when I wake up, I remember the truth. It's awful." "Why don't you think of it as extra time with him?" she said. "Try to enjoy that time." I looked at her, thinking of everything I was going through and how she had to be feeling just as much and more. I felt like I would never be as tough as my mother. "How are you so strong?" I asked her. She came over and held me. "Anything is doable as long as it's time limited," she said. "This pain will never go away, but it will get easier." My mother was so sad, but so brave at the same time. Once, when she was at work during this time, she had a contentious exchange with a table full of doctors at the hospital. Uncharacteristically, she burst into tears. While crying, she choked out, "These tears are not about you. They are about my husband. But don't let the tears dilute the content of my message." What a great line. She is so right. Like my mom, I am by no means a woman of steel. And as the years have gone on, I've come to realize the truth of what she modeled for me. It's okay to get emotional. It's okay to cry. And this is key, as long as you can play hurt. My mom always told me one of the tests of an emotionally healthy person was how quickly they could recover from a setback. The test of strength is not avoiding emotional distress. It's functioning in the face of it. Those first few Christmases after my father's death were rough. We took comfort in each other and in the maintenance of our family routines. Mom would always cook a big breakfast Christmas morning. She even did it the Christmas right after my dad died, a week to the day after we buried him on a bitingly cold, gray, snowy day. Every year thereafter, we always got a tree and decorated it, drank eggnog, and sang Christmas carols, with one less stocking by the fire. We worked hard in those first few years after my father's death to find opportunities to smile. One Christmas, Mom sent me and Suzanne to get the tree, insisting, as she always did, that it be a Fraser fir. She said Douglas firs shed their needles everywhere. "No problem," we said. "Go now," she said, "or they will all be gone." But we were watching our favorite Christmas special, The Christmas That Almost Wasn't, and this was before the invention of DVR. "We'll be fine," we told her. "Go," she cautioned. Sure enough, by the time we got to the tree farm, there were no more Frasers. We bought a Douglas, and before we brought it home, my sister looked at me. "This is a Fraser," she said. "Got it? Repeat after me. This is a Fraser." When we got home, Mom took one look at that tree and, with hands on her hips, said, "That is not a Fraser." "Yes, it is," Suzanne said. "It is," I said. We had barely gotten the tree decorated when needles started falling off. Suzanne and I doubled down. "This year's Frasers seem off," we remarked. My mom rolled her eyes. To this day, we have never admitted it was a Douglas. I'm having my mom skip this chapter. It was an extra boon that the sheer absurdity of our lie and the intensity with which we maintained it gave me and Suzanne a good laugh in a dark time. In the years since my father's passing, I've found different ways to remember him at Christmas. The very first time I played guitar was Christmas 1997, 12 years after my father's death. I wanted to surprise everyone by playing Today by John Denver, which has always been such a special song in our family, as it was one of my father's favorite campfire songs during our summer trips. My friend at the time said, "I don't mean to discourage you, but it's 2 weeks until Christmas, you don't know how to play guitar, you don't own a guitar, and you don't even have the music to the song." I was undeterred. I bought a classical guitar for $100. I found the sheet music by walking into about 7 guitar stores and singing the song until someone knew it and how to get it. I taught myself how to fingerpick the tune late at night after work. And then I sneaked the guitar home for the holiday, having a cab instead of my mom pick me up at the train station so no one would see I had it. On Christmas morning, I came downstairs in my red pajamas and told my brother, my sister, and my mom I had a special gift for them. And I started to sing. Today, while the blossoms still cling to the vine, I'll taste your strawberries, I'll drink your sweet wine. 1,000,000 tomorrows shall all pass away, ere I forget all the joy that is mine today. I played and sang today for them, and I wrecked Christmas. I could barely make it through the song without breaking down. Okay, I did break down. And so did every member of my family. It was like I set off a sadness bomb. I went to the bathroom to clean up my tear-stained face, and my sister Suzanne came in. "Meg," she said, "that was wonderful." "No, it wasn't. I ruined Christmas." "You didn't," she said. "I made everyone cry." "You made us feel him, Meg. You made us remember what it was like to have him here. You didn't ruin anything." In truth, even now, all these years later, I'm never far from my father's life and his death. Ever since his passing, the fear of my own mortality has haunted me. For many years, I worried that I had some gene that would take my life early. There were some advantages to this. After my dad died, I started eating well. As soon as I could, at 16, I started teaching aerobics and did that for 10 years. I was determined to try to stay alive. And then, when I started having children, that desire became even more acute, and I began to obsess over mortality. For years, starting in high school, it was as if I could hear my heart beating, each thump a reminder of the passage of time. Every time I hit that brick wall of unhappiness, I hear my heartbeat grow louder. Because of that night, with my sister coming into my room and the paramedic's face and my dad on the gurney and my mom in the parking lot, I know I only have limited time here. I mean, I know it. Not just in my head, the way everyone does, but in my heart and in my gut, the way those who suffer great loss do. But this newfound sense of urgency didn't immediately bring a higher level of clarity or calling to my life. On the contrary, it sent me reeling. Recently, I came across my old journals, which I've been keeping since I was a kid. Here is an entry from June 12, 1989, 3.5 years after my father's death. "I feel so helpless sometimes. I know that my destiny is in my own hands, but to what extent? There is so much to think about. Family, friends, career, life. Will my grandchildren read this years from now and see it as the only thing to remember me by? No legacy? We're here for such a short time. But what exactly are my ambitions? I thought ambition was viewed as bad, as wrong. It turns out it's the key to everything. Where will I be in 10 years? I want to be successful. What do I believe in, really believe in? Hell, Megan, what do you even know about the world? I want to know what my teachers know. Where is it all, in books? I know where it is. It's in years and years of research and experiences. That's not something I can just have. I have to go get it all for myself. I'm just sitting here wondering who I really am inside. And who am I to become?" A few years after my father's passing, Mom met a wonderful man, Peter Kerwin, in a support group for widows and widowers. He had lost his first wife to brain cancer and nursed her himself to her dying day. Peter was great for my mom, and for me too. He could never take the place of my father, but he was a good-hearted, good-humored, strong male presence in my life at a time when I really needed that. Peter came to the relationship with 3 children of his own, Paul, Patrick, and Liza. Paul was strong, good-looking, and easygoing. He's now a police sergeant in Albany. Patrick was about the gentlest soul I'd ever met, quirky and loving and all kindness. If any of us needed anything, Patrick would be there, first in line with a screwdriver or a moving truck or whatever else, and probably a corny joke, too. And Liza, now a critical care nurse, was full of fire. She loves music, sings like an angel, and floors us all with her acerbic wit. Like my dad, Peter is a devout Catholic, and as a young man, he too had considered the priesthood. When my mom's friend heard this, she asked Mom, "Does your mother know you're boinking all these priests?" When Peter and my mom got married, they had 5 priests standing at the altar. 2 were friends, 2 were from their respective parishes, and I don't know where they found that other guy. It was a beautiful service, very pious, as you might guess, and full of family. All 6 of us looked on, relieved to see our mom or dad finding love again, but also deeply saddened at the reality that life really does move on. I don't call Peter my father because my father didn't abandon us, and I want to honor his memory. But Peter is as much a father figure to me as any man could have been. He's provided a shoulder to cry on more times than I can count. He's given counsel in the dark times and shared my joy in the highest moments, always with a thoughtful word. We tease him because he tends to see things in extremes. Everything with him is either magnificent or devastating. There's very little middle ground. Conversation with him is exciting. My dad was an intellectual. Peter never finished high school, but has a college degree in life. He's a true partner to my mom. Peter is the first to go with my mother to the garage sales or grocery stores. He'll drive down to Nana's apartment to fix her TV or take her to the craft fair. He brushes Nana's hair and dyes my mother's. He and my mom laugh and fight and make fun of each other and knock things over out in public. They're like a comedy act. They kill at the Grand Union. He's an excellent dancer and roller skater, like Danny Terrio of Dance Fever on skates. I know this because we used to go roller skating as a family, even though it was long past that sport's heyday. Peter also happens to be a neat freak, which is good, since my mother hasn't ironed a piece of clothing since 1980. One time they were having an argument in their upstairs bedroom. Suddenly we heard some sort of glass break. Moments later, we heard Peter's footsteps. Step, 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 step. Then the sound of the vacuum cleaner. And then the argument resumed. Peter has always honored my father, often going to plant flowers at his grave. "You're just going there to complain about me," Mom teases him. "Yes," says Peter, without missing a beat, "and there's usually a line when I get there." Chapter 4. Who's Getting Hit First? When my mom told me she was marrying Peter, I was a sophomore in college. I loved Peter, and I was happy for her. But I also felt a renewed surge of mourning for my father. It had been 4 years since Dad had died, and it still felt like yesterday to me. After I'd congratulated them, I went back to my college apartment in Syracuse and wept. My boyfriend at the time, Jim, came over and held me for a very long time. I leaned a lot on Jim in those days. College until I met Jim had been pretty predictable. I'd always known I would go to Syracuse University, though I'd never thought much about why. It just felt comfortable. My mother had gone there, my father had taught there. It had this air of home. I remembered my years in that city so fondly, and I wanted to be where my dad had been. I walked through the Syracuse Department of Education, where I taught aerobics for a time, and saw a poster for the Edward F. Kelley Evaluation Conference, an educational competition that was started the year after he died and which exists to this day. Someone there told me about how much my father had meant to him and dug up a photo of me from a work picnic, a tomboy swinging on a tire swing, smiling. A picture that captured exactly how I felt as a kid. Free, full of life, loved. But mostly I just ambled through my days, obsessed with college boys and my weight. I skipped classes to hang out with friends. My journals are replete with messages amounting to, "I don't know why he's not calling," or "I have to lose these last 5 pounds." How I would love to go back and talk to that girl. Some of my apathy came from not having gotten into the journalism program. When I was accepted to Syracuse University, I applied to the famous Newhouse School of Communications, but was turned down, and so I entered the Maxwell School of Political Science instead. I had set my sights on the news business after my sophomore year in high school, when they gave us a written aptitude test. Mine said I should be a journalist. I did a 2-day internship with the Albany Times Union. I got to follow a reporter around all day as he talked to politicians and worked his sources. I thought it was thrilling. I also took a journalism class in high school. We watched All the President's Men, and I found it deeply inspiring. Less inspiring was the day when our teacher wrote the following on the chalkboard and told us someone had actually written it on an exam. Pulitzer Prize. For Pulitzer Prize. No, it was not me. Other than that, my news experience consisted of the time my high school cheerleading squad won the Northeast Regional Competition, and we stormed the studios of the local CBS station, did a cheer, and insisted that they mention our victory in the nightly newscast, which they did. It was the first, but not the last time I would cajole a newsman into putting me on TV. Anyway, when I started at Syracuse in political science, I figured I'd eventually transfer to journalism. But then I got sidetracked. At a recent event, I sat next to Stephen O. Newhouse of Condé Nast. I teased him about how the school named after his grandfather had turned me down. "I read that someplace," Steve said, and I called up an administrator at Syracuse and asked, "How did that happen?" "That's all I ever wanted to hear," I told him. Vindication is sweet. When I started college, it had been less than 3 years since my father's death. I was still mired in sadness, and it influenced the way I socialized. After I left home, I noticed that it was harder for me to enjoy things on a superficial level. In college, I pledged a sorority, Tri-Delt, and fell into a group of six women. People called us the six-pack. They were fun, kind young women, but they were also normal 18-year-olds. Secretly, I felt like I had nothing in common with them. I recently heard from one of them. She remembered me as quiet and serious. It was in this mess of emotions that I met Jim. Jim had the greatest impact on me of anyone in my life at the time, outside of my family. He changed me as a person in profound ways and was easily the most important thing that happened to me in college. I met him sophomore year. He was a senior. I was working as a waitress in an on-campus cocktail bar called Harry's, where he was a bouncer. He used to walk me to my car at the end of the night after our shifts were over. One night we kissed. He came back to my apartment and we fooled around a bit. I fell asleep, and when I woke up the next morning, I was fully clothed, Jim was gone, and his t-shirt was in my bed. Immediately I drove to where he lived. "I have to talk to you," I said. "I'd imagine so," he said. "Did anything happen?" "No, but only because I'm a nice guy," he joked. We hit it off instantly. I was very attracted to him. He was so strong in so many ways, but as I would later come to see, so damaged in others. Jim was the youngest of nine. He grew up in Yorktown Heights, outside of New York City. His dad was a cop, and his mom worked in a factory. Jim had eight older siblings, some of whom had severe substance abuse problems, as did his dad. His father and some of Jim's older brothers used to get very rough with each other. They never hit Jim. They called him the Christ child. But as a little boy, he would have to jump out the window and go sleep on the neighbor's couch to feel safe. He was the first person in his family to go to college, and it came through, of all things, lacrosse, which he had become quite good at as a kid. I came to know the lacrosse world very well. Lacrosse communities have a lot of blue-blooded kids, but they also have a fair amount of tough kids like Jim from more blue-collar areas. Jim got into Cornell and was told he could have a full athletic scholarship. After his first year there, his brother called and said, "You have to leave." "Why?" Jim asked. It turned out there was no lacrosse scholarship. Jim's parents had been working double shifts for months to try to keep him there. Jim left Cornell the next day. He started shopping himself around to any place that would give him a full ride. The legendary coach at Syracuse, Roy Simmons Jr., brought him on, all expenses paid. Simmons later told me that in all his years of coaching, he'd never seen all 70 guys write down the same name for captain until Jim. He was a natural leader. He was courageous. They won three Division I national championships. Jim knew a thing about grit. Jim always said the key to winning a confrontation is for the other side to believe you'll fight. Then you won't have to. One time we were taking a vacation, and two punk kids were crossing in front of us in the crosswalk. One of them punched the front of Jim's car. Jim was out of the car in a flash. "All right," he said, matter-of-factly, "who's getting hit first?" They ran. He defended my friend Marla in a bar. Some guy wanted her to dance, but it was clear she didn't want to. The guy wouldn't take no for an answer and was grabbing Marla. Jim pushed the groper against the wall. "She said she doesn't want to, pal." I never saw him actually throw a punch. He was quick to downplay his own accomplishments, which were plentiful, certainly on the athletic side, and he wasn't afraid to show who he was and where he came from. One year we went to a Final Four championship dinner. The teams included Yale, Loyola, UNC North Carolina, and Syracuse. Each captain gave a speech to a packed hall. The guy from Yale said, "There have been a lot of eyes on Yale this year, a lot of questions about us. People wonder why we do the drills the way we do, why we warm up the way we do. The way we wear our socks is very innocuous. It's all about teamwork and brotherhood." Jim gets up there for the Syracuse team and says, "I can't speak for all the teams, but we at Syracuse did not have our eyes on Yale, and we didn't wonder about their drills or their socks. But we were wondering what the word innocuous means." To this day, I admire the way Jim owned his roots. I learned from him that being self-deprecating doesn't show weakness, it shows strength. Just as those who tell you how amazing they are all the time are probably masking something absolutely not amazing. The 6'7" center doesn't tell you how tall he is. Jim made me laugh. When we met, he had a lot of acid wash pants. It was 1989. I didn't like them, and I made sure they went away. This would repeat itself later with Doug. Then one day I came downstairs to meet Jim wearing a black velvet bodysuit. "What is that?" he said. "I have to express my individuality," I said. "I tried to express my individuality," he said, remembering his jeans, "and all my clothes got sold in one of your mother's all-you-can-grab-for-a-dollar garage sales." I felt his pain years later when Doug and I were going to a prom-themed party, and I went looking through the basement for my prom dress. When I asked my mom what happened to it, she said apologetically, "All you can grab for a dollar." Once I met Jim, all bets were off. He filled a void left by my father's death. We were inseparable. And he gave me the first real confidence boost I'd ever had. I knew I could perform socially. I had a high EQ. But before him, I didn't think, "I can do anything." Jim helped me focus on the importance of believing in myself. He helped me clear out the negativity and self-doubt in my mind. My journal entry from the summer after we met reflects this. "I'm young. I can do so much with my life. I can really be somebody," I wrote, "but not without effort. I see opportunity, but I've got to go seize it. I have to work twice as hard. I can succeed. I can do it. Take control, Megan. Nothing is holding you back." Jim used to call me little girl, which was ironic. His attitude was the opposite of belittling toward me. It was tongue-in-cheek, like calling a big guy tiny. He would say, "You got this, little girl." He was sweet but tough, chivalrous, which is a great thing for a girl missing her father. He made me feel like no one was going to hurt me while he was around. I felt connected, believed in, and supported. We had a lot of fun, too. I studied abroad in Florence, Italy, my junior year. I created a job for myself teaching aerobics over there. I brought my mixed tapes from the States, rented a big room in an office building and a stereo system, and did it all in Italian. I figured the room could take 50 girls, and I charged each girl $100 a semester. Suddenly, I had $5,000. That was a lot of money for a broke 19-year-old girl in 1990, and I used some of it to fly Jim over. We had a romantic week together, culminating in a trip to Elba on our last day. It was a wonderful time. If you told that girl that her future wasn't marrying Jim and living happily ever after by his side in upstate New York, she would not have believed you. But time would prove that Jim was not the man for me. As the years went by, it became quite clear we were very different people, with divergent goals. It eventually ended with great sadness and affection. I will always be grateful to Jim for the support he gave me. He was there for me during many dark moments of missing my father. No one else was as much of a comfort to me. I think it's because his childhood had been rough, and so he had the wisdom and gravitas to handle my grief. When my insecurities would creep up about school or friends or my future prospects, Jim would tell me, "Don't let them get to you, little girl. You know who you are." He believed I was strong and helped me believe it too. Sometimes I wonder if he's seen me on TV and whether he knows that what I've accomplished is in part an accomplishment of his. He gave me the confidence to do everything I've done. I doubt I would be here without him. By my second year of college, I found myself thinking more and more about law school as a next step. I'd actually been considering it since my freshman year when I had taken a class with a political science professor named Robert McClure. He was a tough, no-nonsense professor whose class I loved. I learned quite a bit from him about how to make an argument, and more importantly, that I loved to argue. By the time I was a junior, I had decided to become a lawyer, which was empowering as a decision. I'd been searching for what my path would be and how I'd take control of my life, and now, finally, I'd seized upon one. From my journal entry on January 26, 1991. I am 20 years old now and have actively begun to make what I want happen. It's a good feeling, though certainly frightening. I know who I am becoming and who I want to be. The horrifying threat of misplaced nostalgia will never affect me as I age, for, succeed or fail, I will have accomplished the satisfaction of attempting. When I applied to law schools, initially, I thought I wanted to go to Notre Dame. It was Irish and Catholic. It was in South Bend, Indiana, and I thought it might be fun to see a different part of the country. Plus, it was a great school. I was turned down by Notre Dame, but got a yes from Albany Law School, ALS, right in my hometown, so I could live at home and save some money. Besides, everyone says it's the Notre Dame of Albany. I would need all the confidence I got from my family and from Jim, because law school was not for the faint of heart. The work was intense and the competition fierce. However, to my mother's delight, not only did I thrive in law school, but I paid for it myself. My favorite class was taught by Professor Bob Tyman, a crusty old guy, good-humored but sarcastic as hell. He taught torts and contracts, or as he put it to folks at cocktail parties, "I use a little blue book and a little green book, and I teach people how to think like lawyers." Tyman paced around the well of a grand amphitheater-style classroom with about 100 students wrapped around him, going up several levels like a waffle cone. He, like most professors at ALS, used the Socratic method to teach, walking you through your logic until you at last realize the folly of your position or the soundness of it. Imagine skipping the homework and then being subjected to that. At ALS, often we were forced to make our arguments on our feet, going at it with our professors, with an audience all around us. I loved every minute of it. Tyman once pulled me aside to tell me, "You really seem to be enjoying law school." My God, I thought, I made an impression. Not everyone was pleased with my classroom enthusiasm. I sat near a woman I will call Jane, who informed me that some had taken to referring to me as Barbie. Jane would often tell me the negative things people had to say about me. I was offended by the nickname, but also a little inspired by it. "You think I'm a ditz? Stand by." I've had this feeling many times in my career. Being underestimated is a gift in many ways. One day it dawned on me. Jane enjoyed relaying this information just a little too much, and she was not my friend. "You know what, Jane," I said, "do me a favor. Stop telling me the bad things people say about me. I don't need that kind of negativity in my life." "Fine," she said indignantly. "I was only trying to help." I put up with her for a long time, but by our final year of law school, I'd had it. "Hey, Jane," I said, trying to figure out a class's seating chart. "Do you know where we're sitting?" "Figure it out yourself," she said, to which I responded, "Shove it up your ass." That is the only time I have ever used that phrase in my life, mostly because once you've really nailed it, you should leave well enough alone. Though Jane probably wasn't rooting for my success, I could feel myself gaining a self-assurance that I had never felt before. I was coming alive, but it wasn't just in my classes. As much as I loved studying and arguing and learning, the thing I was absolutely dying to do was moot court. Students were not allowed to audition for the trial team until their second year, and even then the team consisted mostly of third-year students with only one or two second years. So my first year, I watched with envy as the upperclassmen practiced and competed. By the time second year rolled around, I could barely contain my anticipation. I checked the door of the coach's office several times a day, awaiting the sign-up sheet for tryouts. I could think of nothing else. In all, there were 8 spots, 4 on the first-tier team and 4 on the second tier. I was determined to be first-tier, and I knew in my bones I could do it. This was not the result of some unbridled confidence in myself. I never thought I'd be a great scientist or dancer or contestant on Jeopardy. I also knew I would never be number one in our law school class. Those folks seemed to have truly special brains. But I knew almost as soon as I got into law school that I could stand up and make an argument. It's not like I'd been winning arguments my whole life, I hadn't. But in the same way my friend Bob Clyatt picked up clay from his son's middle school art class and suddenly knew he was meant to do something with it and is now a successful sculptor, I saw the students on their feet making arguments during my first year and knew it in my bones. Yes, I can do this. I'm a big believer in that old Henry Ford quote, "Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right." Moot court is where that all started for me. Looking back, there were signs to support my confidence. While I hadn't been focused on academics in high school, I loved public speaking. It was my favorite course. After my father died, I'd written and read aloud a poem about loss that took every ounce of strength in me. I swallowed hard to make it through without crying, only to look up and see I was the only one who wasn't. And like my mom, I also enjoyed being on in a room. I had her authoritative voice. A good voice is important for any public speaker, but especially for a woman. In fact, I believe women with very high voices should consider voice training. There is no better way to be instantly dismissed, other than bad wardrobe or makeup choices, than to sound like a child when you talk. I'd used my voice to great effect during one of my jobs in college as a telemarketer. Though I'd continued teaching aerobics throughout college, I had also taken up selling 1-800 numbers for businesses as a way to make more money. At first, I found I couldn't sell very well if I used my own name. I did much better if I used a fake name. "Hi, this is Rachel calling," or as my mom would say, "Rachel." That kind of acting was an effective tool and a skill, one that I honed later as a young lawyer when I was deposing powerful, high-rolling clients in cases where millions of dollars were at stake. If I failed, it wasn't really me, but an alter ego. That took some of the pressure off. With Rachel and my voice, I became a killer telemarketer and made excellent money for a summer job. They never made it official, but I felt sure I was chief telemarketer. The end result of all this was that I knew I was good enough for the trial team, even though it was quite competitive. Still, there was no question I was going to have to work at it. Everyone wanted one of those spots. I spent the summer of 1993 studying the sample criminal case they gave us, a notebook filled with transcripts and other evidence against a young fictional man who had kidnapped and raped a fictional woman named Lynn-Ann Montoya. They left it up to us whether to argue the prosecution or the defense case. I was always more inclined to put criminals behind bars rather than keep them out, so that's the side I chose. Not to diminish what criminal defense attorneys do, I respect them greatly. They serve an important role in our criminal justice system, which is stacked against defendants and does get abused. But I found the idea of prosecuting cases honorable, and that's what I wanted to do. For weeks, I prepared, studying the case, crafting the best legal argument. Night after night, I sat in my bedroom, working at my assemble-it-yourself particle board desk with one bright lamp. I wrote and rewrote the most compelling closing argument I could. I spent days tightening the logic, tying the evidence together. I looked deep in the case file for clues that might bolster my circumstantial case. In the end, after many weeks of writing, I knew I had something that would sing. I practiced in front of the mirror, my friends, basically anyone who would listen, which more often than not meant my mom, my stepfather Peter, and my sister Suzanne. I remember sitting my mom and Suzanne down in fold-out chairs in my sister's backyard one day and delivering the whole closing without notes, spelling out what had happened to Miss Montoya in great detail. When I got to the most gruesome part, my sister said loudly, "That's disgusting!" "It appears we've won over juror number two," I thought. The day of the tryout, I was like a racehorse in the starting gate. I walked into the classroom where tryouts were. It was cold and white, with about 20 desks and chairs and not much on the walls except a blackboard in the front where I was. And then I saw him, in the back of the room by the windows, the legendary Ken Mullally, Yale and NYU law grad, former federal prosecutor, head trial team coach, and beloved criminal procedure professor. He was about 6 feet tall with a full head of dark hair, smart, confident, and infamously unsparing in his analysis of students and life. Next to him was his assistant coach, a young blonde woman I had never seen before. "Glad to see there's no bias against young blonde women in this room," I remember thinking. There were very few words between us before I got started. "Hello," I was told. "State your name. Please proceed." The room around me seemed to disappear. This is something that happens to me to this day. It's as if adrenaline shuts out all stimuli outside of the thing on which I have to concentrate. I took a deep breath, looked them in the eye, and before I knew it, I was off. For 20 minutes, I waxed on about the defendant and Miss Montoya, hitting the crescendos and decrescendos, holding back at moments, raising my voice a bit for dramatic effect, and building the drama to the end. I wasn't nervous. I was exhilarated. I could do this. This felt right. I believed in my case. I knew I could convince them. "Stay cool. Stay collected," I thought. "Don't get too emotional. Don't oversell it." "The defendant is guilty," I said. "He kidnapped this woman in broad daylight and then subjected her to hours of unspeakable cruelty. What will he do if you acquit him, ladies and gentlemen? Do you want this man back on the streets, around your families? Don't make the same mistake his victim did. Don't trust him." When I was done, all Malilly said was, "Thank you." I was a little disappointed. I thought I'd nailed it, and I half expected on-the-spot feedback. Maybe a "great job," or in a perfect world, "you did it! Welcome to trial team." What I got instead was a nod toward the door, which I then opened and walked through. What I didn't know then was that Malilly and his assistant coach had looked at each other after I closed the door and high-fived. Malilly later told me in his office that I was not only the highest-scoring candidate for the team that year, but the highest-scoring candidate they had ever had. He also kept my ego in check, telling me never to refer to the jury as "ladies and gentlemen" because it's alienating, and that I had violated a major ethical rule by trying to make the jury fear for its own safety. Whoops! Overall, it had gone great, though. As a kid who never excelled particularly in anything but being popular, that moment was the first taste I can ever remember of knowing that I could do something, and then hearing someone else confirm, "You're really good at this." That's a marker in time for anyone. More than simply boosting my confidence, it confirmed that my instincts about myself had been right. Because I grew up the way I did, I'd been honest enough with myself to know what I could and couldn't do. With moot court, I'd been able to sense that fine line between hoping I would be good at something and actually being good at it. That kind of self-awareness rarely just happens. It needs to be cultivated. Having that intuition about my own abilities validated was a crucial first step toward believing I had promise in this field. It started to dawn on me, sitting in that office in my jeans and a t-shirt, sporting a ponytail of blonde hair, that I really might be more than a cheerleader who could type fast. Chapter 5. Trial Team Barbie. Law school was challenging, in a great way. Generally, with every tough class I weathered, I grew more certain of my abilities. But then, a setback. At the end of my first year, I failed to grade on to the Albany Law Review, the prestigious student-edited law journal. "You didn't grade on? Wow," said Jane, a little too gleefully. Being on the Law Review is basically a year-long homework assignment, but it is also a huge resume builder. If you finished the first year in the top 10% of your class, you automatically graded on. I was in the top 12%. But anyone in the top 20% could attempt to write on to the Law Review instead, which requires a hell of a lot of work the summer after first year. I was determined, and I just about killed myself working to write on in the summer of 1993. Every spare hour of every day, I was working on that Law Review piece, finding holes in my arguments, perfecting the language. At the same time, I was preparing my trial team audition, as well as working nights and weekends teaching aerobics, and working full-time during the week for a local law firm, at which I was busting my ass. The senior partner and I worked together all summer on a case involving a patron at a bar who got drunk, drove home, got hurt, then sued the bar. I had done a ton of research and witness interviews, and spent a fair amount of time briefing this partner. One day, he called me into his office. I walked in full of hope. This is it, I thought. He's seen how hard I've been working. He's going to give me a really good case, or a job offer, or a recommendation. Megan, I've been thinking, he said. That was good. He was thinking. About me. Surely about the long hours I was putting in for the firm. Then came the kicker. I'd really love to set you up with my son. I stood there in shock. I didn't want to go out with his son. I wanted an assignment. Here I was working tirelessly at this firm because I wanted him to see me as a future associate, not as a future daughter-in-law. He went on to tell me how attractive I was, just his son's type, and would I consider a dinner out with the two of them. I realized he meant no offense. This guy was born around 1930 and raised in a different time. That's not an excuse, but it is an explanation. These days, I think we're much more conscious of the fact that we don't only praise the girls for being pretty and the boys for being smart. Many women I knew at the time were sent similar messages, that no matter how tough they were or how hard they worked, ultimately they were more likely to be pulled in for a chat about their dating status or their looks than for a conversation about their career. No real harm was done to me in this exchange, but it was a moment in which I remember realizing that I might have challenges getting some men to take me seriously. I didn't spend much time thinking of it as good, bad, or otherwise. I viewed it as information. This was something I would encounter, so I had to learn to deal with it. The bottom line for me was, no, I did not want to date his son. Besides, who had time to date? I had to write on. In August, the letter arrived with the law review decision inside. I picked up the envelope, praying. I understood how much was riding on this. It was my last shot. There were no do-overs here. I held it up to the light, trying to see through the envelope, as if that protective layer between me and the news might somehow cushion the blow. After about a minute of that nonsense, I ripped open the envelope. I had done it. The significance of that moment cannot be overstated. In fact, one could argue that my entire future depended on the strength of the article I submitted for that write-on competition. Without that feather in my cap, I almost certainly would not have caught the eye of my eventual law firm, which only accepted one or two students from my class in a very competitive process. I came away feeling empowered. I am in charge of changing my life, and hard work matters. I didn't need money or connections to power or the natural advantages some of my classmates had. Through sheer force of will, I could get myself where I wanted to go. Between writing on to the law review and making the trial team, I was feeling increasingly confident in my skills as a potential lawyer, a feeling that only got stronger once I actually started competing in moot court. To this day, my moot court experiences in law school are among my best memories. In my second year of law school, my friend David Hillman and I partnered up for the Gabrielli Appellate Advocacy Moot Court Competition. We were given a case to study, then we had to write an appellate brief, and for months on end, we argued the case before appeals court judges, sometimes real ones, sometimes professors playing the part. For weeks at the beginning, we toiled away in the small, rundown law school cafeteria, arguing over what each of us believed were our most persuasive positions. We both had strong personalities, which led to many heated discussions. Generally, however, we worked things out. In the afternoons, we hunkered down in the school's one-room computer lab, along with dozens of other competitors. As this was before the days of everyone having a personal computer, we hovered over each other to type the brief and make it look professional. I remember looking out the window at the gorgeous upstate New York fall day and thinking, I want to be out there. But I knew I was working toward a goal. Beauty, nature, and fun would have to wait. As it turned out, they would wait a long damn time. When the competition began, Hillman and I wouldn't find out until right before we got up whether we were arguing for the appellant or the respondent, so we had to know both sides of the argument cold. This required a ton of work, but made us much better advocates. It was also a skill that would serve me well later in my law career and my TV job. I used to say at Fox News, when we still had a show called Hannity and Combs that involved a conservative versus a liberal, that I could sit in for either guy on any given day. So, by the way, could Hillman. Hillman and I were very frank with each other. He spoke with a charming Queens accent. There is no accent I like more than the New York City one. I like to read the paper in the morning. That's very important to me, Hillman would say. And after the arguments, I thought you've done better. I'm not gonna lie. I enjoyed being with him, even given the sharp elbows, which I threw right back. Come to think of it, Moot Court was actually excellent training for the debate prep I do with my colleagues Brett Baer and Chris Wallace to this day. And just as Hillman and I gave each other a hard time, Chris and Brett and I never mince words. That's too wordy. No one will understand that. Aren't you missing the real issue? In both cases, the combative preparation made our work better. We made it to the finals on November 18th, 1993, my 23rd birthday. The competition was held at the law school's biggest auditorium, a gleaming, brand-new amphitheater that commanded all eyes to a stage down below, with an elevated judges' bench in the front. There were two lecterns in the front of the bench, with a desk for the advocates beside them. The room sat several hundred people. That night, it was standing room only. People filled the stairways and balconies and doorways, and I was both thrilled and nervous as hell to get up there in front of them. Then, as now before a big event, I would look at the clock a day earlier and say to myself, 24 hours from now, it will be done. Just get through these next 24 hours. The argument was before three judges from the New York State Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York State. Knowing the legal brain power that would be testing our positions was disconcerting, but it was also good practice for being a lawyer when your adversary is getting paid to destroy your argument. Before we got started, the four finalists had dinner with the judges at the law school. I was starstruck by the intellect in that room. This might never happen to me again, I thought. One of those judges, Judge Vito Titone of Staten Island, in appearance and demeanor, reminded me of then-sitting Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and he was one of the most respected people on the court. In one quiet moment, Hillman told Judge Titone how honored we were to be there. Really, no matter what happens tonight, Hillman said, we've already won. I looked at my partner, who, by the way, is now a gifted and successful lawyer in New York. What are you saying? I thought. And Judge Titone said what I was thinking. Second place is losing, son. When it was my turn to argue that night, I got up, looked at the judges, and had a bit of a moment. There they are, I thought, and here I am, on my feet, making an argument, and ready, I knew, for anything they might throw at me. Well, I hoped that was the case. Please, God, let me be ready for anything they might throw at me. I started talking. May it please the court, counsel, and I was off to the races. By the time I sat down, I felt as if I'd swum the Atlantic. My adrenaline was pumping, but the relief at being done was enormous. The arguments went well on both sides, so much so that when it was all over, it was not clear to me who had won. Much as they do with the Miss America pageant, they read the results of other, lesser awards first. Of the 300 people who had participated in the competition, so-and-so wins most improved, such-and-such wins best brief, we won third best brief, and so on. By the time they got to the winner of the finals, my heart was in my throat. Hillman and I held hands and waited, eyes on the table in front of us. It had been our friends, two guys we really liked, opposite us that night. It was a little tough to root against them, but we wanted to win, and badly. If we have to lose, I remember thinking, it wouldn't be terrible to lose to these guys. What I was doing was something Dr. Phil McGraw advises. Answer the what-if question. When something's bothering you, answer the what-if question and get yourself okay with that imagined result. It's a technique for handling stress, and it works like a charm. Finally, they announced the competition's winners of second place, a preposterous term, and we heard our names. All the blood seemed to drain from our faces. Dejection immediately set in. Those warm feelings I had been having about our friends across the aisle turned to sour, biting ones. These two guys? Seriously? Suddenly, we wanted nothing more than to get out of there. I hated the feeling. And yet I knew I could do something with this misery. After all, how can you know how much you hate losing if you never experience it? I can draw on that dejection right now. It's still there at the ready, and it is indeed a powerful motivator. Before the night was over, the woman who ran the competition, Patricia DeAngelis, who went on to become a tough-as-nails district attorney in New York State, presented a special award. I had known Trish, a slender brunette with a take-no-prisoner style, since my days as a Pop Warner cheerleader, and we had become friends again when I got to ALS, where she was a year ahead of me. She stood before the auditorium, packed with my classmates, professors, and some high school friends who had showed up to provide moral support, along with my mom and Peter, and she said she had one more special announcement to make. This year, they were presenting a Best Individual Advocate Award. The top advocate in the competition, as decided by all of the judges throughout the year. She talked about the amount of work the contestants had put into this competition, the number of mock arguments and the scores we had accumulated over many months before dozens of judges who tested our mettle. Hillman and I sat there, half dying just to go home, half hoping we might still turn the night around and hear one of our names. I was too afraid of the terrible losing feeling hitting me in a 1-2 punch again to get my hopes up. Trish, holding the award in her hands, a wooden gavel engraved with the winner's name, said, "I remember when I first began planning this year's competition. I asked the person who has now won Best Individual Advocate what date I should have the finals on, and she said to me, 'Have it on my birthday, November 18th. You could hear my mother's loud, joyful sob from the audience. You would have thought this was an Academy Award. My mom gives me a hard time sometimes, but she's also my biggest fan. She may not believe in false praise, but when praise is due, as in this moment when I was rewarded for what she knew to be months of insanely hard work, she has always been quick to offer it. She's not the kind of parent for whom nothing is ever good enough. Some things are good enough, and this award was one of them. Peter later told me it was magnificent." Trish concluded, "And when Megyn Kelly thinks back on her 23rd birthday, it will be a day she never forgets." And she was right. It was an incredible moment. And yet, despite my growing confidence in my ability as a lawyer, I never got too drunk on my own wine. Then, and now, I was Linda's daughter. I knew who I was and what mattered. I could fill this book with things on which I need to improve, and at which I am simply no good. But I also know what my strengths are, and this self-awareness has served me well. This approach was later encapsulated by Professor Malilly in what I now call my Albany Law School theory of life.